This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a food preference expert about why our tastes change as we get older.
First, we're focusing on some news from the U.S. Small Business Administration. According to their state profiles, Wisconsin has the highest rate of small business survival in the Midwest.
Wisconsin's small business survival rate is also higher than the national average. And while this may seem like good news about Wisconsin's economy, there is more to this story.
Dale Knapp joins us now. He's the research director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Dale, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
So when it comes to startups in Wisconsin, there has been some iffy news, but this seems to be one thing Wisconsin is doing right. The businesses that start up are surviving. They're doing pretty well. What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, it's something that we've written about a couple of times, that Wisconsin's sort of different from a lot of states in that, one, as you mentioned, we have this relatively high survival rate. So after 10 years, typically about 40 to 41% of those new startups are still around. The national average is only about 34%. So we do much better than the national average, much better than most states. The other side to that coin, though, is that we don't start very many small businesses. When you look at new firm creation, we're typically in the bottom 10 states in the country. So we don't start many, but those that we start tend to do pretty well.
It's an interesting kind of dichotomy there. What do you make of the fact that we're not starting more businesses?
Well, it's something that we've pondered for quite a while now. And in talking with people around the state and people that are involved in starting businesses, it seems to come back to an economically conservative attitude, that we're a little bit more cautious in the kinds of firms that we're going to start up. We want to make sure that there's a good chance that they succeed. So we seem to be a little bit more risk averse than some other places. And we've also heard that from people that have started their businesses or are running small businesses, they seem to believe that the financial system, bankers, et cetera, are much more risk averse here. And so they're not willing to finance riskier startups. They're willing to finance the safer ones. And so that seems to play a role in it. And you look at our venture capital numbers, the last numbers that we have, Wisconsin gets about $34 per worker in venture capital, the money that these startups rely on. Nationally, the average is over $200. So there's not a lot of risk capital coming into the state either.
So Wisconsinites or the entrepreneurs in Wisconsin are more cautious. Sounds like the banks are more cautious as well. Where do you think that tone of caution comes from?
Well, some would say that it's really it's historic. It's the types of people that settled here, the Germans from Europe, the Norwegians. They tend to be, when they got here, they tended to be more blue collar, very risk averse, and unlike many other states, we don't leave the state. So many other states, they may have these, established by Germans as well, but there's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of people that leave the state and come in. When you look at census data, we tend not to leave the state, and very few people come to the state, so we still have that really strong German-Norwegian heritage here, which I think still plays into it somewhat.
So you're saying as a state character, maybe we are just naturally more cautious, and that might just be what it means to be from Wisconsin to a certain extent.
That might be. And there's, there is an upside to that. We seem to get hit, less by big recessions to generally, the financial crisis hit us a little bit less than other places. Housing market did not do as poorly here as some other places. So there's some good in being conservative. On the other hand, when you look at the numbers, those states that tend to have fairly high firm creation rates, whether or not they survive a long time, those are the ones that tend to have higher job growth. And the reason seems to be that they, you know, by creating a lot of firms, they tend to get, they tend to hit the big ones. They hit the home runs, essentially. And so, you know, they get the Microsoft or they get the Dell computer, those kinds of companies that we don't necessarily seem to get as much.
Does the survival rate also speak to the levels of support that we have in Wisconsin for new businesses?
It may, but, you know, we've not seen anything that would indicate that we're vastly different from other states in that regard. So, you know, there can be a lot of things that are playing into this, but, you know, it seems to come back to just this risk-averse nature to some degree that we tend to have.
Well, what do you think we need to do as a state to overcome that risk-averse nature and get people taking more chances on business?
Well, you know, again, I do think that, one, we need to, you know, really find ways to attract those kinds of entrepreneurs here. That's one thing, you know, and find ways to attract the financing for them. You know, there are organizations out there that are working on the venture capital side to try to get those dollars in here for those companies that would be a little bit riskier. But I think, you know, sometimes it just pays to get lucky. I think, you know, Epic is a good example. Epic and Madison, they do medical records, had been around as a small business for a long time and really sort of hit it at the right time around 99, 2000 and has exploded. And so it's something that in the Madison area has really built off of that. And so, you know, we need to find ways to fund those kinds of businesses that, you know, at the time might have been a little bit risky because, you know, when it was established, it was unclear whether there was going to be a big market for this. It happened to work out. So bringing in the capital, bringing in the human capital, the young entrepreneurs, that's going to be the way to do it. And you look at our migration numbers, bringing in the young entrepreneurs is going to probably be a bigger challenge than bringing in the capital.
Now, we hear a lot of times that most new businesses fail. It's a hard thing to succeed at. Do these numbers about survival rates for new businesses in Wisconsin mean that Wisconsinites should take heart and maybe this is a pretty good climate to start a good business that will survive, you know, longer than the average?
I think they should. I mean, I think, you know, the numbers, you know, indicate that you know, our overall business climate is probably pretty good for small businesses. You know, we generally do, as it shows, pretty well. But as we go forward, you know, we want to be a state that's to some degree, you know, leading in terms of job growth, in terms of the new economy. We can't rely on you know, the manufacturing as we have in the past because we know those kinds of jobs are struggling to grow. So trying to find what our niche is in terms of the ever-changing economy and nurturing those kinds of businesses can go a long way to creating an economy that is going to prosper over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Dale, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, glad to be here. Thank you.
We've been talking to Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
Coming up next, a food preference expert explains why our tastes change as we get older. But first, Kristen Durst joins us now from the newsroom with a look at headlines. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When I was a kid, I used to hate avocados, but now I can't imagine life without guacamole. And apparently I'm not alone. A lot of us experience a broadening of our taste preference as we get older, and we like stuff that we used to hate when we were kids.
Well, that goes for some of you. Some of us like exactly what we liked when we were kids and nothing else. Marcia Pelsha is with us today to talk about this topic. She is a sensory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. Marcy, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start with the basics. What is it about being a little kid that can really make them be a picky eater?
It's actually normal for children to be picky compared with adults. Picky eating involves eating an especially narrow range of foods, and kids, you know, generally do not enjoy all of the foods that adults do. But children who are picky eaters might be extremely narrow and maybe only eat 5 or 10 different foods. When that happens, people become concerned about their nutritional well-being, although, in fact, most of the time, kids are getting a balanced diet and their weight is normal. It's just more of a social problem.
If we look at this from, you know, an evolutionary point of view, it seems like it would benefit kids if they ate more stuff that they'd be more likely, you know, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, to survive. So why is it that kids would be pickiest when they're little?
Well, it is true now that we have a fairly safe food supply that, yeah, sure, it would be better to have a more varied diet, it would be more balanced. But, well, back in caveman times, at least, the average age of weaning was around 2, and children would begin eating on their own then. And at that time, there were lots of things around that were poisonous, and it was better for them to, you know, just sample a little bit of a food or just to eat what they saw older members of their group eating, and to gradually build a wider repertoire of foods.
So these days, when do kids start to get out of this phase of being picky, and how do you get the data on that?
Of course, we would love to do longitudinal studies, follow the same children throughout life. Nobody funds that kind of research, including the federal government, unfortunately. But by studying children at different ages, at looking at their reactions to foods in the laboratory, observing them in naturalistic settings, scientists can begin to get an idea of what happens. And probably the peak of pickiness is around 2 or 3 years of age. Although, unfortunately, that's also the time that kids are likely to go under the sink and swallow something poisonous. Or, you know, so you're sort of, you've got the worst of both worlds. There are certain times when kids become a little more independent of their parents, when they start kindergarten, when they go to high school and start going out with their friends, not with their parents, when they go away to college, that their food experiences can really broaden. It's been shown with college students that if you give them successful experiences with new foods, you find unfamiliar foods that actually taste good, and, you know, you give them 4 or 5 of those, the next time you offer them a new food, they are more willing to try it.
Right. That's what you hear as a new parent. I'm a parent of young kids, and what I heard was that if they don't like it and they reject it and they spit it out and make that face, you should just present it again, that you should present the food maybe 4 or 5 times before you really put it on the will not eat list. Is there anything to that?
As a matter of fact, with my kids, I never put things on the do not eat list. I mean, I unfortunately did a paper on the odor that asparagus creates in urine. Very scientific paper and important, but nevertheless, my daughter heard me talking about this when she was a young child, and has refused for many years to even try asparagus. Now that she's 16, she is finally willing to try it, although she doesn't quite admit that it's wonderful yet. My son really didn't eat eggplant, which admittedly is a difficult vegetable when cooked properly. It's sort of grayish-brown, mushy, but, you know, it can be delicious, and many adults love it. And so it really wasn't until he was out of college that he liked eggplant. So I say never give up. I didn't force these foods on them after a while when I realized they didn't like them. They were always required to come up with a nutritionally appropriate substitute for foods that they didn't eat.
Wow.
And that taught them nutrition, and it was quite inconvenient for them when they were little and didn't cook and couldn't reach things. But, you know, they could go get some baby carrots or, you know, whatever out of the refrigerator, and that was fine. And now both of them eat just about everything.
You know, earlier you said that a lot of times you see these changes at certain times in a child's life when they're becoming independent of their parents. And
yes.
What sorts of things do they explore at those times? Do they just sort of rebel against the parents, or are they just more open to trying something else, whatever it might be?
Well, a big factor is peer pressure. They see other kids eating kiwis, and even though they might never have eaten a kiwi, if other kids say, oh, they're really good, you know, they do become more willing to try them. And then, of course, when they get older, it's embarrassing to go out to a Chinese restaurant with friends and not be able to eat anything with hot pepper in it. And, you know, dating, you certainly don't want to go on a date with someone and have to just eat rice and meat on a stick.
So in other words, if you're going to be a sort of a flexible person in society, you have to be able to embrace a variety of circumstances and a variety of foods.
Yes, and there are picky eating children who grow up to be, well, they call themselves selective eaters. And one of the things that bothers selective eaters the most is that they're limited socially. They can't go to someone's house for the weekend or go to a business lunch. They have to say, I'm not very hungry, or I had a stomach bug, I'll just eat some bread or something like that. So it is difficult. Eating is a very social activity for humans.
Could part of this be that kids just taste things more strongly than grown-ups do? I can remember when I gave my son his first avocado, and he had a full-body grimace, writhing reaction. It seemed like a very strong reaction. It seemed like he was tasting more than maybe an adult would.
Well, you know, it is surprisingly difficult for us to really know. Yes, children do seem to have a bigger reaction to things that they put in their mouths. And then they, you know, once they've gagged on something, they seem to be worried that that's going to happen again, and that keeps them from trying new things. But the question is, did they really feel it more strongly, or is it just that for them, at an early age, everything is unfamiliar? And all other things being equal, people like familiar foods better than unfamiliar foods. So, yeah, it was sort of a ghastly experience. But, you know, maybe it's hard to tell whether the sensory experience is actually stronger. Another sensory part of flavor that people tend to neglect is smell. And, of course, for avocado, there's not much of a smell. Broccoli is, you know, a vegetable that many people reject. And it's often said that it's because it has a bitter taste, and maybe children sense it as being more bitter. But, you know, broccoli contains sulfur compounds, and when it's cooked, that smell, that rotten egg or rotten vegetable smell, is released.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Marcy. We're out of time. But thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
We've been talking with Marcia Palsha, sensory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Social issues are factoring into the governor's race. Coming up a little later, we'll find out if the economy will take a back seat in this year's election.
But first, the conversation about military veterans often centers around challenges such as post-traumatic stress disorder, suicide risk, and other psychological conditions.
But our next guest says we've gone too far in talking about veterans as victims, that we've attached a stigma to those veterans, and we need to change the conversation.
McUbbin Thomas Owens is with us now. He is a Marine infantry veteran of Vietnam and a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College. His recent piece, Life After Wartime, appeared in the Weekly Standard. Mac, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start out with this idea of veteran as victim narrative. In your estimation, first tell me a little bit about what this narrative looks like, where I'm going to see it, and what sorts of stories it's going to tell me.
Well, you're going to see it in sort of the idea that that anybody who's been in combat is going to be suffering things like alcoholism, drug problems, homelessness, incarceration, or post-traumatic stress disorder, all these sorts of things in a way that exceeds that of the rest of society. It's really something that began with the Vietnam War. I think maybe a little bit less of that now, but even in sort of a benign way, there's this idea that anybody who's been into combat has somehow been victimized by the experience. And you know, I try to contrast it. I used the example of General James Mattis, who is, I think, probably esteemed as one of probably the best four-star generals we produced in a very long time, who used the term post-traumatic growth, and recognizing the idea that, yeah, people go through combat, they've suffered something, but the fact is that suffering can be the basis of a growth rather than the idea that they are victims or somehow diminished by that experience.
Did there used to be, in your estimation, a different narrative about veterans before Vietnam, or was there a narrative at all? Because it seems as though, like, particularly after World War II, veterans were everywhere.
Sure. I mean, I think basically the idea was that when people went to war, when we had war, men went to war, and that's what expected of them. I mean, the fact is that some came back in better shape than others, and of course, we, you know, badly wounded veterans, we can certainly see that. But there was some sense, I think, of an honoring of them in a way that you don't see today. And don't get me wrong. I mean, things are much better now than they were during the Vietnam years. I mean, the fact is that those people, these days, who are opposed to the various wars, don't take their anger out on the soldiers the way that I think the anti-war folks around the Vietnam time frame did. But if you look back, you recognize that, again, you had these, they went by different names. In World War One, it was shell shock, and in World War Two, it was combat fatigue. It was this recognition that that war has a psychological impact. But it was really with Vietnam, I think, with especially a lot of the anti-war psychiatrists at the time, Robert G. Lifton and some others, who really developed this narrative that Vietnam was probably the worst war in the history of the world somehow, and that therefore anybody who'd been in that war was going to be traumatized to an extent that had not occurred before. And as I say, well, that stigma is diminished to a certain extent. I think it's still out there.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure that what we're hearing you say is clear. You're not saying that soldiers don't come home with problems sometimes. It's what you're saying is that oftentimes the magnitude of those problems are overplayed in the media and other places that don't necessarily represent the proportion of veterans that might have some of these issues.
Absolutely. I mean, look, one of the ways I may, in the piece I wrote, I make a distinction between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. The latter is you know, psychoneurological condition that's of extended time. We certainly know that it exists. But, you know, anybody who's been in combat is going to probably go through some phase of post-traumatic stress. The fact is, what do you do with it? Do you come out stronger or worse? And again, I'm certainly not denying the existence of these post-traumatic stress disorder or anything like that. I'm just saying that sometimes, for both ideological and bureaucratic reasons, there's been a sort of an incentive to over-diagnose the malady.
And so in terms of where we see that narrative in our everyday lives, where do we see that? Is it in news stories? Is it in politics? Where?
Mostly in the news. And again, I hate to pick on journalists and so forth, but the fact is that if you're going to say that suicide is more prevalent among veterans, then what you need to do is sort of the basic idea of comparing cohorts by age, basically. And when you start to do that, you find that the idea that that veterans are more likely to be incarcerated or that veterans are more likely to commit violent crimes, you have to compare them to the age cohort, and you find that the differences are not that great. That tends to be an age-specific thing rather than the experience. That's the biggest problem I see.
And, you know, when soldiers come home, especially, you know, lately, we're often eager to help them in any way that we can. So does that mean that in some ways, do we fall into that narrative too?
Well, I mean, again, as you know, things are much better. So I'm hardly going to criticize people who want to treat returning soldiers well as opposed to what happened during the Vietnam years. But I think that it's easy for one to make a pretty quick transition from this idea of helpfulness to the idea that somehow what we're helping are these poor, disturbed guys who've just been through so much. And again, not denying. I mean, there are different levels of combat, you know, people coming home with all of these. One of the ironies, of course, is that people who would have died of their wounds even in Vietnam now come home and survive. And so things like traumatic brain injuries, things like that, I mean, they're very clear we're talking about this. But this idea somehow that just anybody who's been in combat is somehow is diminished by that, is made worse off by that, I think, is something we need to fight. And everybody needs to fight it, the veterans themselves. And I think there has been pushback on this. I think, again, in my article, I mentioned a couple of people who have done that. About the same time that I wrote that piece, there was a piece by a returning Marine veteran, also from Iraq, who commented on this, sort of, again, in the attempt that people were taking to try to be kind to him and so forth, came across as a sort of a pitying sort of a thing.
Yeah, in fact, you open your piece in the Weekly Standard with a note from a reader who says that veterans should be treated not with sympathy or pedestals, but real gratitude. And could you talk about that concept for a second?
Yeah, I mean, there's I guess part of the problem here is that that on the one hand, we have to be very careful about putting soldiers somehow on a pedestal, looking up to them and admiring them for doing, you know, what they've taken to be their duty. That's one extreme. The other, of course, is looking down at them to basically pity them or to feel sorry for them. I guess that's the same thing, to feel pity for a soldier to have been this. It's a matter of one citizen to another looking the citizen in the eye and basically recognizing the what that individual has done, the sacrifice that individual has borne, in a way that neither elevates him to something above other citizens or diminishes him below other citizens.
How likely is it, though, that given sort of the heightened awareness we have of veterans and some of veterans' issues, you know, we've been hearing all these news stories about the VA and waiting times and problems facing vets coming home and all of those things, that we're likely to sort of be able to step back and take that look at a veteran as being in that role as opposed to putting them on a pedestal or putting them in some other situation.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's also, I also think I can make a distinction between, you know, treating somebody who's been in combat as somebody who's been, I hate to use the word, but victimized by the VA, you know, which is this massive bureaucracy, where in fact there has been dereliction, bureaucratic ineptitude, and even to the extent of criminal ineptitude and so forth. But that's a different matter than the sort of the what I think is this general narrative, perhaps, that that I had in mind, this idea that anybody who's been in combat, that anybody who's chosen to serve their country somehow has been victimized by that experience.
We're talking to McCubbin Thomas Owens about what he calls the veteran as victim narrative, treating war veterans as psychologically damaged victims of their military experiences.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a veteran, what do you think of the case our guest is making? Do you feel like the experience damaged you or strengthened you, or maybe a little of both? Do you think civilians overlook the bonds of camaraderie you maybe had during your time of war? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll be continuing the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Vietnam veteran McCubbin Thomas Owens, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. He's making the case that we should stop thinking of veterans as victims and recognize instead the strengths they may have gained from their experience at war.
And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what our guest has to say as veterans, as victims? If you are a vet yourself, do you agree that people take a look at your story as being a victim of your experience? What would you like to say to civilians, maybe, or the media, who don't understand what it's like to be at war, for better or for worse? Again, that number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. Now, Professor Owens, one of the things that we haven't talked about so much, we've been talking about the narrative, the general narrative of veterans as victims, but what about strengths that veterans might pick up as a result of their experiences? You talked about the PTG idea before that we heard a little bit about that idea of post-traumatic growth. Are those two things related?
I think so. I mean, one of the things that you gain by spending some time being shot at by people who are trying to kill you is a certain degree of resilience. You know, things that might bother other people may not bother you quite as much. So there's the old, if something I saw in Vietnam, I think everybody was in Vietnam, you know, to those who fought for freedom, you know, freedom bears a certain, is a little bit sweeter. And I think that's part of it, sort of the recognition that, you know, in much of the world, sort of prosperity that we Americans take for granted is not there. And the fact that we fight for this, we come back, we certainly have to go through periods of readjustment. That's what families and all the helping organizations are for. But the idea is that if you are so inclined, and I think most of veterans are, you can see this experience in war as an opportunity for growth rather than somehow that buying into the Vietnam, the victim narrative.
Yeah, and speaking of that period of readjustment, in your article you cite a colleague who invokes that idea of a hero's journey to make the return and emerge stronger as a result of that. How does a veteran go through that type of transition, that journey?
Yeah, it's Dave Dinello is a very bright guy. He was wounded in Fallujah, who basically, you know, talks about you know, all the great sort of universal myths like Odysseus' return from Troy. And the things that he goes through. I mean, in his view, these universal myths. And by the way, the original meaning of the word myth is is not something that's false. It's a story. It's a Greek word, and mytho, I mean, is basically a story. So these are stories, I think, that that feed into the idea that that human beings undergo this test, you know, descend into Hades, whatever you want to call it, and then return, and they make their way through these obstacles and adjustments and so forth. And of course, again, it's not something most individuals can or want to do by themselves. That's the role of families, you know, basically understand what they've done, but at the same time, not try to, you know, basically treat them like they're fragile flowers that you know, can't be addressed. I think, you know, engaging people, you know, most, to be, in my experience, my dad was in two campaigns in the Pacific during World War II, and I noticed, you know, he never really wanted to talk about things, you know, and so I think that sometimes it's hard to get people to talk about them, but at least provide the opportunity. I think that's perhaps something that can be of utility to them. But again, just the love and support of families and community and the like, I think is probably the best thing that's going to help.
And listeners, if you would like to join in, 800-642-1234. We've got an open line for you, I think. Right now, let's go to the phones, and Scott joins us from Janesville. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I have friends that are veterans from World War II on up to current. My son-in-law is a U.S. Marine currently stationed in Yuma, Arizona. Has two tours under his belt in Afghanistan. And largely from what I've heard from veterans past is Korea and Vietnam were largely unpopular wars because no American home soil or, say, shipping or anything else like that was attacked, and it wasn't a retaliatory event. Servicemen nowadays do deserve accolades because it's an entirely volunteer force. We have people willing to go in and serve their country with, you know, nothing in return expected except they want to do it. I myself am not a veteran. I was injured in an industrial accident, and being a little bit disabled, I am medically ineligible, and I missed my chance. And my father, on the other hand, he was born in 1928 and enlisted in 1944 in the Navy. He was 15 when he enlisted and 16 when he shipped out to Guam. He was on the invasion force of Japan, felt that it was his duty, even at that young age.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate that. And Mac, what about that idea? He mentioned that Korea, Vietnam, unpopular wars. And you mentioned earlier that sort of changed the narrative in your viewpoint. The fact that the wars were so far away and so, I guess, sort of abstract in some senses, to the American public. Do you think that played a part in this?
Well, sure. Not so much Korea. I mean, we think of Korea as the forgotten war, but I think it really a lot of this crystallizes with Vietnam. Now, remember, I mean, the fact is, you know, I made the very good point that today's military is a volunteer force, but we also, we drafted people for World War II as well as for Vietnam. But there was a time, I think, even at that point, that people thought that this was something that you did. Now, admittedly, the purposes of the war, you know, certainly the Vietnam War had its unpopularity, but the fact is that, you know, it was, I'm sure people will disagree, but I mean, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was a de facto declaration of war, so it was done constitutionally correctly. And, you know, certainly at the time, if you go back to 1964, 1965, well up into 1966-67, the war was generally popular among the American people. It's later in 68 and later where it becomes very unpopular. But even though you had a very substantial anti-war minority, you'd call it, were very vocal and very influential in thinking about this. And I think they helped to set the to create the narrative. As I say, it's much reduced from what it once was, but. But again, I think you can trace its origins to that point specifically.
Do you see one of the things I'm curious about is why you chose to write this piece now? We've got a lot of soldiers, men and women, coming back. from war. Did you write it for them or for the public at large?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, I think that, one of the things that I thought I would get much more pushback on the PTSD aspect of it, but the fact is most of the veterans I've talked to pretty much agree with me. But I think there's it's sort of a recognition. I mean, this is something that General Mattis said in his speech that I cite. And he's talking to veterans of Marine, Special Marine veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, and saying, telling them not to buy into this sort of thing. So I think I was trying to basically reinforce his message, but at the same time, a little bit of education for people who may, in many cases, not even realize what they're doing. Again, I use this example of the Wall Street Journal piece by the Marine who was talking to this woman, and it was very clear that, you know, she wasn't anti-war in any sense of the word, but she, her whole tenor seemed to be that, you know, somehow she just felt sorry for him because of what he's been through.
You mentioned the speech by General Mattis, and when that speech happened, it got a fair amount of play. And I'm sort of wondering, is this the right time, in your estimation, to be having this conversation? And what kind of reaction have you gotten to the article that you've written so far? You haven't quite gotten some of the pushback you expected, but what have you heard?
Well, I mean, it's very rarely when I write anything, but most of it's been very positive. And I think General Mattis' speech was positive, too. Again, what you have, I don't know if you're familiar with this guy, but, you know, he's, as I say, one of the, you know, greatly respected four-star generals I mean, whenever he comes here to the War College, he's the only four-star that routinely gets a standing ovation because he is very capable of certainly rallying the troops and speaking in a very inspirational way. And I think it was heartfelt. I mean, his speech actually, the bulk of his speech was on that. This was in response to questions where he really takes on the victim the veteran as victim a narrative and tries to make the point for post-traumatic growth. Now, by the way, he's been making that for some time. It was just this particular speech seemed to get more publicity than some of the things he said before.
Well, Mac, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. That was McCubbin Thomas Owens, Marine Infantry veteran of Vietnam and a professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College.